This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of the interrogators and translators implicated in the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal are civilian contractors, not members of the military. They are employed by private companies which have been hired to provide services in Iraq. This raises many questions, such as, what kind of training do these employees have? To whom are they accountable? And what laws regulate their behavior? There are about 20,000 private contractors in Iraq, most of whom are doing work that had previously been performed by members of the military. My guest, P.W. Singer, is an expert on private military contractors and how they are changing the American military and the wars it fights. He's the author of the book Corporate Warriors and is a fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he directs the project on U.S. policy toward the Islamic world. Singer says the private contractors at Abu Ghraib are one example of how traditional military and intelligence roles were being outsourced in Iraq without public discussion or debate. Questions about them were raised today at the Senate hearings on Iraqi prisoner abuse. I spoke with Singer earlier today. Let's just start with an overview. To your knowledge, what has been the role of private contractors in the Abu Ghraib scandal?
From what we know, there was a presence of about 30 private contractors in the prison working for two separate firms, Titan and CACI, which a lot of people call CACI. They were working as translators and interrogators. Now, in Major General Taguba's report, he specifically identifies four of the employees as being involved in the crimes, two from Titan and two from CACI. Now, he specifies that, for example, they gave orders that they knew would lead to physical abuse and torture, and he also finds that a good number of them lied to investigators about the activities that were going on there. Interestingly enough, he also found that one of them didn't have a security clearance and so should not have been there in the first place. Now, what's worrisome is that there have been media reports that it goes deeper than that. We have to remember there's a good number of annexes that are still classified, have not been revealed yet. And at least in some newspapers from reporters who've seen those annexes, it appears that one of the contractors has been accused of raping a juvenile male detainee. And what's unfortunate on top of these crimes that they've occurred is that while the soldiers involved are being court-martialed. You have six of them are being court-martialed. 17 have been removed from duty. The contractors involved have neither been criminally charged yet, nor detained, nor even fired from their jobs.
Are they still working in the prison?
We don't know. Probably not after the last couple of days. But it's important to follow the timeline here. The crimes happened in the fall. The investigation takes place in January. The news doesn't break until May. So we had, in a sense, 4 months to get this straight. And at least at the point of when the news broke, the individuals had not been criminally charged nor had been fired yet. The companies, in fact, defended themselves, saying at the start, the leaders of the companies said, well, we didn't have any people there. We don't know what you're talking about. And then when Major General Taguba's report went public and specifically identified their employees as being there, they changed their story and said, well, actually, we've not been notified by the military of this report, so why should we have fired these guys if the military never told us to? And so that opens another can of worms as far as questions. Either the military did not communicate Major General Taguba's recommendations, and so that raises a question as to why the very professional recommendations that the investigator made were not carried out in the 4 months in between, or they were communicated and not followed through. Either answer really isn't a satisfactory one here, given how explosive these charges are, and also given the fact that it appears that we're holding the soldiers to a different standard than we're holding the private contractors.
What do you know about this company, CACI?
CACI's a large defense contractor, mainly has specialized in the information technology realm. It's based in Arlington, Virginia. It doesn't have all that much of a controversial past. There's a number of companies in this industry that have a lot of skeletons in their closet, some of which have gone public and made a lot of news. But CACI's not one of those. So this is the first time it's really been dragged into the public venue. It's a company that's been very profitable recently and has done a lot of business, particularly in the post 9/11 world. And it's made a number of acquisitions in the last couple of years. Now, it's been very public about its role in the interrogator world. It's not something that was kept covert or on the black ops side. In fact, if you went to their website on the job section, there were public advertisements calling for interrogators to work for the firm. Now, what's a concern is that allegations have been made that their screening was not up to par. For example, the personnel that didn't have the security clearance that ended up there. Also, a former employee of the company has gone public and said, this former employee who did have an interrogator background has gone public and said a number of the people who were working alongside him as interrogators actually did not have that training beforehand, that somehow they made it through the screening process. Now, Khaki's responded to that and said, no, we don't know what you're talking about, and we do very stringent screening, and only 3% of the people get hired. But you have these allegations going back and forth, and it's very worrisome. From my perspective, it almost doesn't matter what type of screening the company has. The burden here in the national security realm, at the end of the day, falls on the Pentagon. The Pentagon can't simply punt the problem to the private companies and say, okay, you take care of the security screening. You take care of confirming whether these people have the training that they say. These jobs are obviously too important to just outsource not only a job itself, but also making sure the job is done right. And that's unfortunate that we've stepped away from that responsibility. It's bad public policy, but it's also being a bad client.
Is this the first time in an American military action that private contractors have been used as interrogators?
This post 9/11 world is. We've heard reports, and they're fairly well substantiated, that private contractors were also serving as interrogators in Guantanamo and in detention facilities in Afghanistan, as well as other places in Iraq. But it's certainly not something that we've seen before that in any other war. We've never turned over these responsibilities to private corporations, you know, certainly not as far back as, you know, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. But we have to remember also this industry really didn't exist until the early 90s. But if we look at the operations that took place since then, the Somalias, the Bosnias, the first Gulf War, et cetera, you didn't outsource such a critical area's interrogation to private contractors.
Now, another private contractor that's involved in the Abu Ghraib scandal is called Titan. What do you know about mm-hmm. this company?
Titan's a very large company, also within this information technology private military world. It's based in San Diego. Its particular contract that touches on this realm is a large contract for analytic support and translators. It recently re-upped that contract about a month ago for a little over $170 million. So it gives you a sense of how lucrative this work can be for a corporation. Business analysts look at it and say, actually, this is responsible for much of their profit jump in the last couple of years. Now, Titan is currently being bought by Lockheed Martin. And what's disturbing is that in this merger, it appears a lot of things have come to the fore that are of concern, of question. It appears that there have been allegations of violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in at least five different countries committed by Titan personnel. And that's led to an investigation within the Department of Justice and the SEC, et cetera. And what we're seeing across this industry writ large, not just with the Titans of the world, but pulled back with the Halliburtons and the DynCorps, et cetera, is they have allegations that happened in the past, and yet the government continues to hire them without without thinking about how this affects the broader marketplace. Now, one of the things, again, is the question of how Titan has responded to these instances. Titan, at least as I understand it, as most analysts understand it, had the translator contract. And originally, the company responded that no, there was no people from our company within Abu Ghraib. We simply weren't there. And then the report went public, and listed beside two of the individuals' names was Titan. And in fact, laced throughout the report was references to Titan. So it appears that they definitely were there. One of them has written beside his name in bold, suspect. So it's not a question of whether they were there or whether the Army found that they were suspected of crimes. That's within the report itself. And so, again, this question is not just how did the Army respond, but how are the companies themselves responding?
What roles did the employees of Khaki and Titan play in the prison abuse? Do we know that?
This is something that's still under question, and we have to rely on a limited number of sources. And we also have to remember that there's certainly biases within each of these sources. They're everything from statements that have been made by witnesses, statements that have been made by those accused on the military side, the enlisted men who are being court-martialed. And so obviously they have certain incentive structures there. The document that I think is most reliable, of course, is Major General Taguba's report, because he's the investigator of this. And from his report, it appears that the contractors were put in a position of doing what's called MI work, military intelligence work. They were doing interrogations. And at a certain point in the process, it appears in the late summer, early fall of 2003, there was a change in how we were processing these prisoners. And the military policemen were requested or ordered or got the understanding — this is one of those things that's going to be debated in the legal system — that they should move from just serving as guards, that they should move to helping to prepare the prisoners for interrogation. Or in the words of one of them, they were told to, quote, fear up the prisoners. And it's from this that the abuses stem from. And there's also allegations of abuses that took place within the interrogations themselves, where the MPs weren't present. These are, for example, the explosive pictures of the prisoner who's the dead body of the prisoner who's been put on ice, and the allegations made that he'd been beaten to death during one of these interrogations. There's also a question as to what they were doing, in a sense, outside their duty, and that's the connection with the contractor who's accused of raping the juvenile male detainee, that this was not during an interrogation, that this was, in a sense, a crime committed on this fellow's free time. There's a whole realm of questions here about not just what roles were the contractors playing, but also broader questions of who brought them in, who knew what, when, where, and at the end, when these crimes were committed, if they were committed, how were they responded to? And this leads to a broader question of why certain annexes within the report are still classified, because at the end of the day, they're not classified information in the sense of about troop movements, etc. They're simply witness testimony as to what went on there. And that's a broader concern that Congress has right now as they try to get to the bottom of this. Why are we keeping some things restricted and other things not? And in particular, why was this not passed on in the 4 months beforehand when we had to deal with this?
Where do these private companies fit in the chain of command? Who do they answer to?
That is one of the most key concerns about this industry, is that actually they don't fall under the formal chain of command. At the end of the day, they're private companies and they're civilians that are part of them. So they aren't wearing the uniform. They're not part of the military, even though they're part of a military operation itself. At the end, they're responsible to their contracting firms, and the firms are responsible to the contract itself, not part of the military system, not part of, for example, a court-martial process, not part of a system where you can order them into certain areas or order them to pull out of certain areas. There's two layers of decisions that are added to this military realm that don't exist when you just have troops there. One is at the corporate level and one is at the individual employee level. And at the corporate level, it's everything from how the companies recruit, who they choose to hire, their standing operating procedures, their risk-reward analysis, where they choose to deploy, where they choose to suspend operations, where they choose to pull out. All those decisions are moved from the military into the corporation itself. But also you have to remember there's another layer there, because the corporation can't order around its employees the same way that, for example, in the military, a sergeant could order around a private. They can only threaten to fire the employee or dock their pay. They can't threaten to court-martial them. And so the employee themselves decide what companies they want to work for, what procedures they want to follow, what ones they choose to interpret another way. What's their own risk-reward analysis? Where do they decide the money's worth it to go? Where do they decide it's not? Also, personal issues come in ways that don't with soldiers. For example, a private military employee can decide to go home because his his wife had a baby and he wants to see them. These are all levels of discretion that aren't within the regular military. And so the concern here is that you've moved the location of decision within a military operation outside the military itself, and therefore made the operation a little bit more vulnerable. The system is optimal when all the forces come together so you get efficiency and quality of service. But the concern is what happens when the system breaks down. And in the military, you have all sorts of redundancies to deal with that on the operation side. And you have all sorts of legal regulations, and specific the military code of justice, if it breaks down in a criminal way. On the private military side, you don't have either.
The military personnel involved in the Abu Ghraib scandal can be court-martialed. They are accountable by military law. What about the private contractors who are alleged to have participated in these abuses? What law governs their behavior? What kind of trial or reprimand would they face?
It's a very good question, and it's one that's really not been answered yet, because you still have these personnel out there. This is a gray area in both international and national law. And the way it works is that with soldiers, they're accountable to the Code of Military Justice. So there's a system set up to investigate, prosecute, and if they're found guilty, to punish them. Civilian contractors can't be held under that system unless there's a formal declared state of war, unless Congress declares war itself. And we really haven't seen that since World War II. So in this situation, they don't fall under the Code of Military Justice, so you can't pursue them that way. So that then punts the situation to the local courts, either in Iraq or here in the States. Well, there's two problems in Iraq. One is that there really is no Iraqi legal system. That's why we're running prisons in Iraq in the first place. And there is no sovereign Iraqi government until June 30th. And so there's a question as to what would happen. Now, potentially you could detain these personnel and hold them until an Iraqi legal system takes hold. But so far we've chosen not to do that. There's a second problem with using it, Iraq as a legal recourse to go after them. Is that the CPA itself passed a regulation that stated that contractors don't fall under the scope of Iraqi law, even if there was an Iraqi law to deal with them. So if you were a defense lawyer for these personnel, you would have a lot of issues to stand with there. At the end of the day, though, we've not seen them pursued under Iraqi law. So that then punts the problem back to domestic law, back here to the U.S. And there's a specific law that would seem to apply most. It's called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, MEJA. But there's two problems with MEJA. One is that there's loopholes in MEJA. For example, MEJA only applies to contractors working for the Defense Department, not working for other government agencies such as the NSA or the CIA, etc. There's also a question as to whether it applies to third-party nationals, for example, an Egyptian or a Ukrainian, etc., who's working in Iraq. How would you pull them back to the U.S. and try them here? The second broader problem with MEJA is that the doctrine around it was never built up by the Defense Department. Basically, they never established how, when, who or where would apply MEJA. So military jurists look at it and say, look, this is a law, but it's of no utility to us. And that's why you see this punting back and forth between the Defense Department and the Department of Justice, where you have Ashcroft saying, well, we haven't been told by the Defense Department to do anything about it. Well, there's nothing in MEJA that says the Department of Justice has to wait. Everybody's interpreting it openly. At the end of the day, though, the law is gray. And so it's not very clear on what to do. And then the second part is we've chosen not to activate it. We've had 4 months to figure out how to apply it, and we haven't seen that yet.
Clarify this for me. Now, I've read that to facilitate outsourcing, the Pentagon extended legal protections to civilian contractors in Iraq. And civilian contractors are protected from prosecution in Iraq for crimes committed as part of their official duties. But then, of course, the question is raised, is, you know, raping a prisoner part of your official duties? Is any kind of abuse of prisoners part of your official duties? And if it's not, can you still be prosecuted for that? Can you explain what this is about?
The original regulation was passed to create an optimal environment for companies to come in, where companies would not worry about what might happen to them and their employees, not just currently, but 10 years from now, will they be held responsible for something they did in the course of their duties. And you have to remember that the companies are providing a whole realm of roles in Iraq, everything from logistics services to training up the Iraqi army to protecting facilities, which involves getting into a good number of gunfights, protecting convoys, et cetera, and also interrogation. So there's a lot of areas that could be controversial here. And so this was passed as a way to clear that up. Now, the concern is that, in a sense, it gives a free license. It creates a vacuum in the law. And we have a situation where we've dropped somewhere between 15 to 20,000 private contractors on the ground in Iraq, and not one has been charged with any single crime. And we all know that if we took 15 or 20,000 people from anywhere in the world and dropped them in a place over the course of the year, some crime would happen, let alone the specifics we know about Abu Ghraib. But we're led to believe that really nothing has happened. And I think that's pretty fantastic. And it questions really the lack of oversight here. Because remember also, the CPA isn't even tracking how many people are working, let alone the potential crimes that are happening. Now, the concern for the defendants in this case, the potential defendants, again, they haven't been charged, is that certainly the CPA could reinterpret its law and say, okay, what you were doing was not in the course of your duties. Of course, a defense lawyer for these people could then say, however, they were part of the military operation. They were carrying these duties out within a military prison, and they might even be able to find certain documents that cover the course of the actions that they took. This is going to be something that the legal system would have to argue out. But really, this is all theoretic because right now they've not been charged in any system in Iraq, in U.S., internationally, et cetera.
Have you been able to find out what kind of training the private military companies give the people who become their interrogators, or what kind of training the translators have who are hired by the private military companies?
One of the challenges of this military outsourcing is that we've moved the decision on issues like recruiting and training to the contractor side rather than the military vetting it itself. And so while you get a good number of personnel who have the training and skills to do these jobs, it appears that a good number are also making it through the process, particularly right now with all the demand for labor. Remember, we have between 15 to 20,000 of private contractors on the ground in Iraq, and so there's been a huge labor crunch, and that some people are making it through this process who don't have the skills to be there or have a background that would mandate that they shouldn't be there working on behalf of the U.S. military. Within the Abu Ghraib case, there's a couple of concerns. For example, personnel that don't have the security clearance to be there. There's an individual in Major General Taguba's report who's specifically identified as not having the security clearance. And what's interesting is that the contracting companies say, well, that's something that the military has to check out for itself. But on the military side and congressional testimony, they've said, well, the companies check that. So this may be a gap that some people are falling through. The other part is whether they have the training to be interrogators. Again, the companies are not providing specific training for these tasks. They're relying on the past training of the personnel within the military itself. However, it appears that they pulled in some people who did not have that military training to be interrogators. There have been two issues that raise concerns. One is that people within the military interrogator world not only expressed surprise that contractors were sent there to do this job, because this was not an instance where we didn't have enough skilled military interrogators within the military already to handle it. For example, you still had the teachers at all the different military service interrogator schools back here in the States. These were some of your best personnel, and you had them sitting on the bench. If you were going to send contractors anywhere, you probably shouldn't have sent them to Iraq. You should have sent them to serve as teachers and deployed the teachers to the field. But we didn't do that. So one is that they were shocked to find that out. The second is they've looked at a number of these names of individuals involved and said, you know what, this is a very small world. There's not a lot of interrogators within the system. Why is it that we haven't heard of these people? And the reason it appears, at least from what other employees of the companies were stating is that not everyone had an interrogator background, that some had a broader intelligence background, such as counterintelligence work, but not interrogation skills training, and that potentially there were people pulled in who didn't even have intelligence background that might have had other training background. One former employee identifies people as having a truck driving background working as interrogators.
Why hire private contractors to be interrogators? Is it a way to save money? Are there not enough people to go around? I mean, you would think that the Army would want control of that. So why outsource it?
That's going to be a major question that has to come out in this investigation, is who made this decision to outsource such a critical role, and when and what were their stated reasons for it. So right now we can only surmise. My sense is that it's not a case of trying to pull in private contractors to do the dirty work that government people couldn't do. I don't think that's the case here. A lot of reports have stated that in the media, but I don't think that's the case. My sense is it's more about a lazy bureaucracy. Basically, the military was given this large check in the budget supplemental from Congress that had no specificity about how it should be spent. It basically said, here's $18.2 billion, spend it how you see fit. Now, to pull military personnel into these roles would have required layers upon layers of red tape and having to task certain people to go here and replace them there, et cetera. And it was just a lot easier to turn to a private company and say, here, why don't you take care of it? Why don't you solve the problem for us? And that's something we've seen in other realms of military contracting, whether it be logistics, et cetera. And that's my sense, is this is what probably happened here. And that's not the best way of doing business. And certainly it's not the best public policy sense, because you need to be thinking to yourself, yes, some roles are appropriate to be outsourced, but other roles are clearly not appropriate to be outsourced. But no one was asking these questions. At a broader level, no one was asking the questions of, would this save us money at the end of the day? We still don't know if it saves us money. And one of the interesting things is the military has been asked to release what the contract was, a specific contract, which agency let it out. And at least within yesterday, they couldn't track down the contract itself.
Let's look at some of the other areas that private military contractors are being used in Iraq. Let's start with the police force. A company called DynCorp was hired to establish the post-Saddam Hussein police system in Iraq. And this is a company that has had serious problems in the past. You want to summarize what some of those problems have been?
The whole realm of military consulting in Iraq has been turned over to private companies. And so you have a system where the post-Saddam police, the post-Saddam paramilitary force, and the post-Saddam army have all been outsourced to private companies to form, advise, and in some cases lead. On the police side, it's a company called DynCorp that's based here in Virginia. It's a large government services company, does billions of dollars worth of business in everything from information technology to this military side. DynCorp had a similar contract in the Balkans during the late 1990s, and what's worrisome is that what we've seen in Abu Ghraib is, in a sense, has some parallels to what happened in the Balkans, where individuals within the firm got involved in some very serious sex crimes, ranging from owning, so to speak, underage women to the site supervisor in Bosnia of the firm videotaping himself raping two young women. Now, there's two concerns on what then happened on top of these crimes. Is the first, because of this gap in the law, the employees who committed these crimes were never prosecuted, even though the Army, for example, had very good evidence, even had a videotape and a deposition from the guy who committed the crimes, where basically he admitted to raping these two young women, but they said, look, we don't have jurisdiction, and so the employees were never criminally charged. That's a parallel with what we've seen in Abu Ghraib. The second is how the companies themselves have responded to employees getting into these troubles. In that case, two employees came forward as whistleblowers, not people who had committed the crimes, but people who were disgusted by these crimes, and told their superiors, and then when there was an action, released it to the public. Those two employees were subsequently fired. And they said, okay, we're being punished for telling the truth here, and they both sued the company. One she won her case in England, and the judge in that situation found Dyncorp's defense to be, quote, completely unbelievable, end quote. And then very quickly afterwards, Dyncorp settled the lawsuit that was carried out by the second employee who had been fired for whistleblowing. That lawsuit took place in Texas, and they very quickly settled with him. Now, Dyncorp has since won a contract to carry out a similar job in Iraq to train up the police there. It says it's taken care of it, that it has new employee vetting procedures to try and make sure that people who are likely to commit these crimes don't make it their way through the process. Also, it makes employees sign documents that state that they understand that, for example, human sex trafficking is frowned upon in the international community. But you still have this broader problem of, at the end of the day, there's little that the company can do if an employee commits a crime. Yes, they can fire them, but when we're talking about felony offenses, it's not enough. And that's the parallel here with Abu Ghraib, is that even if the Titan and Khaki were totally on top of this case and immediately fired the people involved, it's still not enough. If you or I went out and shot someone or committed a felony like rape, no one would say, oh, well, we'll let their employer take care of it. No, you'd say you have to have a legal system take care of it.
It was interesting that after this had already happened, after, you know, alleged rape and ownership, in quote, ownership of young women had already taken place, you know, by a private contractor, that no system was figured out how to deal with it legally. And now here we are, and there's still no system.
It's a tragedy. And we wish we could say that this is something we had no idea about. We didn't even know about this industry, and we didn't know about these potential loopholes in the law. But the fact is, we did know about it. We did know that there were loopholes in the law. Congress made a slight attempt to close them, but the law that it wrote was written quite badly. But more importantly, the doctrine around it was never established. The Defense Department was tasked to lay out the doctrine as to how you would deal with these instances, and it never did. And that's a failure of leadership and follow-through. And it's something that it's interesting because soldiers in the field and officers in the field are very concerned about this, and they're very concerned that you have not just a whole realm of private contractors out there on the ground who aren't part of their chain of command, but also that there's a different system of accountability for their own soldiers than there is for contractors. But we have a senior military leadership and a senior political leadership that's in denial about this broader system. For example, when Secretary Rumsfeld talks about military outsourcing, the examples that he uses are things like mowing the lawns at military bases or answering phones, things that you really wouldn't want soldiers to do just because it's a waste of their time, that you'd rather have them out there doing important jobs. Well, guess what? The reality is that contractors are out there doing the important jobs. And so in a sense, when we use these non-controversial examples, we're not being completely truthful. Contractors are out there doing everything from logistics to training up local forces to actually fighting in battles in Iraq, to doing interrogations. And we have to deal with this broader system. Right now it's unregulated, and there's not the laws in place to deal with what happens when it goes bad.
The four men in Fallujah whose bodies were burned and mutilated and body parts were hung up, they were providing security for a food convoy of U.S. troops, and they work for a private military firm called Blackwater Security Consulting. How do you think that the deaths of these people and the desecration of their bodies has affected the whole profession? I would think that people would be a little less likely to sign up for a job like this after seeing body parts hung up on a bridge.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that there's a broader level of incidents that have gone on in Iraq. Fallujah was not the first nor the last time that contractors had been killed in Iraq. It was just the only one that was caught on film. In fact, the day before Fallujah, two private military contractors had been killed about 50 miles to the north. It just didn't make the news here. Last week, two private military contractors from Oregon were killed. Somewhere around 50 have been killed. We don't have any formal tracking of the number of contractors killed the way we do with public military. And when you add in the number that have been wounded, it's somewhere around 300. That means you have in the range of about 350 casualties that simply the public is not aware of, isn't tracking. Typically, the only way it gets reported is in the local media, be it in Oregon, be it in Fiji, be it in South Africa, when a private military contractor from that local area is killed and in some cases their body is sent home. So it's Fallujah was not a new striking incident that sent a wave of risk concern to the industry. It was contractors on the ground there already knew Iraq was a dangerous place. In fact, when the news broke, I was contacted a couple of days later by a company based here in the States that said, how can we work in Iraq? So there wasn't that sense of deterrence here. Certainly individuals within the firms may have changed their risk-reward analysis. They may have said, you know what, it's too dangerous, I want to go home, or I want to be paid more to reflect these higher risks. But you didn't see mass pullouts. Now, one of the things is what's more important is the broader spread of violence that happened after Fallujah, where violence took place not just in the areas around Fallujah, but also in Najaf with Muqtadar Sadr's forces. And in those cases, what you saw was an array of contracting companies decide to, quote, suspend operations. So it wasn't that they were pulling out, but basically they weren't going to deploy into any risk areas anymore.
What are some of the other roles that employees of private military companies are playing that we might be surprised to hear about? Have they actually been involved in combat?
Yes, and in one sector of the industry, what's called the military provider industry or the private military company sector, in Iraq they're carrying out three types of tactical roles, basically guarding CPA installations, guarding key individuals all the way up to Paul Bremer, and escorting convoys. And what's interesting about this is U.S. military doctrine holds that you should not put civilians in areas where they're going to face risks, and certainly where they don't have to, where they should not have to carry weapons. And only in extraordinary circumstances do you make exceptions to allow them to carry sidearms, to carry pistols. But in each of these contracting areas, you're hiring them for the specific capacity of them to carry out a tactical military job. You don't hire someone to defend a CPA installation from rebel and terrorist attack unless you know they're going to carry weapons and defend it. And there was examples of, for in Najaf and Kut and Heat, where there were battles that lasted throughout the night. In the battle in Najaf, the private contractors from Blackwater literally fired thousands of rounds of ammunition to defend the CPA headquarters from rebel attack. In the case in of another instance where the Hart Group, they were actually under attack throughout an entire night and never got support from the coalition. This is another area of concern here, and had to leave one of their personnel who bled to death on top of a roof because they weren't bailed out in the middle of this battle.
Another thing I've read is that some of the employees hired by subcontractors have worked doing security or interrogations in countries that have a history of dictatorships, and that their practices from having learned the trade in these countries might be very different than the standards we would want to uphold as Americans in Iraq or in whatever country the private military company is hired in. Is this a concern of yours?
It's a major concern, and it's a thread that actually connects Abu Ghraib to this broader system. Again, the companies determine who and where to recruit and who and where to hire and how to vet them. And so the result is that you get a good number of people, the vast majority of people who have honorable military backgrounds and we'd be proud to have there. But unfortunately, there's people who make it through the process who should not, and we should be very concerned that they're there in Iraq, not just because they might not have the training and skills to be there, but because they might have some dark things in their past, particularly in the human rights realm. And I'll give you three quick examples. One was an employee of the Armor Group firm who had actually been kicked out of the British military. He was ex-British military. He'd been kicked out and then put in jail for cooperating with Irish terrorists. So the British were none too happy to find out that he'd been not only hired to work in Iraq by this company, but actually given access to British military bases. And he wasn't fired until an Irish newspaper reported on it. It wasn't the company that found out the practice. A second concern, second example, is there's a very large number of South African personnel who apparently worked for the apartheid regime. And in one specific instance, there was a fellow who had admitted to the Truth and Reconciliation Council that he had firebombed the homes of over 60 political activists. This is not the kind of guy that we want working on behalf of the U.S. military, but in fact he was. And there's a broader set of these people there. South African press has reported it somewhere between 250 and 1,500 of these type of personnel there. My sense is it's towards the lower end, but one is bad enough, let alone 250. And then finally, just as you noted, there's people from countries that have trained under dictatorships and might have some different ideas about how you conduct yourselves in a military operation. And an example of that was there was a contingent of Chileans who had worked under the Pinochet regime, which obviously had all sorts of human rights practices concerns. They were deployed by a private company into Iraq.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has been one of the real advocates of outsourcing to private military companies. How has he been responding to these allegations that employees of private military companies have been involved in the abuses at Abu Ghraib?
Unfortunately, this is a case where we haven't seen the type of response that senior leadership should be given. And in fact, it's the contracting element that's been one of Congress's major areas of concern and actually anger at Secretary Rumsfeld, and not just anger on behalf of the Democrats, but also on the Republicans, because, to put it bluntly, he's not been truthful about the role of private contractors. He typically uses examples of non-controversial elements and never owns up to the broader array of roles that they're doing here, from logistics to interrogations to et cetera. And unfortunately for Secretary Rumsfeld, he committed a major error in that senior leaders in Congress, specifically Ike Skelton, who is the a ranking member on the Armed Services Committee in the House, sent a letter to Secretary Rumsfeld and said, tell us about these private military contractors and what they're doing and what rules and responsibilities they fall under. Secretary Rumsfeld sent back a letter to Skelton that arrived a couple of days after the news about the contractor role in Abu Ghraib was revealed. And there were two major problems within it. It was a very short letter. One, he said, it's not our responsibility. It's the Iraqi Interior Ministry's responsibility. We don't contract with these firms in most cases. And there's two problems with that. One, there is no Iraqi Interior Ministry. There's no sovereign Iraqi government until June 30th. So what he was saying is, don't mind about the last couple years. Just look forward. Don't mind about that. The second is, we are contracting with these companies either directly or in the case of subcontractors, but it doesn't matter because at the end of the day, it's still Pentagon money that's going towards these companies. And at a broader level, Iraq is our area. It's an occupation area. We're in charge of it. But then there was a second part of the letter that was angered Congress even more. He appended a list of private military companies that he said were operating on the ground in Iraq. Unfortunately, the companies in the Abu Ghraib case were not part of that list. So he was saying to Congress, here's all the companies that are involved, but didn't mention the companies that are most controversial right now. And that's something that just basically Congress says, okay, you have to be forthright with us. You have to be transparent. You can't treat us with this amount of disdain. And that's one of the reasons that they're really so angry right now, is that he bluntly hasn't been truthful with them.
Peter Singer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
P.W. Singer is the author of Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution.